thanks for tuning in to another special edition of Down the Line. In this episode, AJ is talking to Christopher Douglas, who played Noel Ace, the young South African airman whose identity was in doubt in the episode of the same name. Christopher is now best known as the voice of Ed Reardon in the award-winning radio sitcom Ed Reardon's Week. Before he became a prolific writer for radio and television, Christopher was a familiar face on our TV screens in the 1970s, playing cheeky barman Martin Bell in Crossroads, spending 4 years on the high seas as Samuel Anedon in the BBC's Anedon Line, and making guest appearances in shows as diverse as Crown Court, Riley Ace of Spies, Cat's Eyes, and Blake 7. Recent radio successes have included David Podmore, which he voiced and co-created, Beauty of Britain with Jocelyn J. Essien, Mastering the Universe with Dawn French, and Tristram Shandy, which won Christopher the 2021 Tinniswood Award. He has also directed for television, written for numerous newspapers, and has penned a number of books too. Over to AJ.
So today I'm joined by actor Christopher Douglas, who listeners will know as the downed South African airman from the episode Identity in Doubt. So Chris, thank you for joining us today. It's great to have you with us. How are you doing?
Well, I'm at the seaside, actually.
Oh, nice.
I've just been for a swim just now. I think it's sort of near Chesil Beach. We've only just got here. But that's why I've got the questionable beach art behind me in the Zoom. You can see, I apologise to listeners who, well, no, actually, I'm quite envious of listeners who can't see the beach art that's behind me.
It's a small picture frame, but it's kind of just all blue and white, isn't it?
Yeah.
If listeners can imagine a little house and a boat, I've seen better.
Yes, you're not missing anything, no.
And are you there on a break, on a holiday? Or?
Yeah, just a little holiday, yes, yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Well, you've got to enjoy the sun in the UK whilst you can, haven't
yes,
you?
Yes, yeah.
I would love to start by asking you how you came to get the role. Did you have to audition for the part? I think it's Noel Ace. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce that surname.
I think it's the first time the name's been mentioned for
40 years. Days.
But I think it's Ace is how you say okay. It. A-C-E, but it's spelt U-Y-S, I think, isn't it? Which is that Afrikaans name. Yeah. Well, at that time, I was working quite a lot in BBC dramas and ITV dramas. I was sort of pretty young. I think I was just 21 or something. There was a lot of work about for people of my age and younger. I'd been not quite a child actor, but an actor from my sort of mid-teens. And there was just lots and lots of work. And I worked pretty much consistently at that time. It got harder. It was about, well, the time I made this was in that episode of The Secret Army, it was about to become more difficult. And in fact, I remember I'd started writing, I think, by the time I made that show, 1977, because it was evident to me that people were coming out of drama schools and I was going to have to find something else to do to support them, because the competition was just about to get very much tougher. So that was why I started writing.
Right.
But at the time, I was in another series. I was a regular in a show called The Anedon Line. Mm-hmm. And I think perhaps there was some crossover with the producers of, I mean, we all used to rehearse in the same building at North Acton. And so there was quite a lot of sort of crossing over between shows that were made there at the time. So I don't think I even had to read for it. I think I was just offered. I think I would have met the director. I don't think I would have been offered it sort of out of the blue. I would have met the director, Victus. And in fact, I think that's what happened. I think that there were this rehearsal room in North Acton was, I think it was on 7 floors. And each of those floors had 2 or 3 big rehearsal rooms. Mm-hmm. So all the BBC shows that needed rehearsal were rehearsing there at the time. So I think I probably sort of went up a floor or down a floor and met the director, and he said, okay, you know, do you want to do this? So I don't think I even read for it, actually. But once I knew I was going to have to play this Afrikaans character, I sort of made sure I listened to plenty of Afrikaans people speaking, and so got the accent.
How did you find that? Was it something, are you able to master different accents quite easily, or did you have to listen and practice a lot?
Yes, I do voices, and I've worked a lot in radio, so I do lots of different voices. But you don't want to get it wrong, you know. You don't
just
say, well, because I do a lot of voices, this will be fine, you know. So I made sure I got it roughly accurate.
fantastic. And how did you kind of approach finding your character as Noel? Is you've got a really interesting storyline. As at first, you know, you kind of don't have much sympathy for him. He appears kind of quite stubborn and uncooperative. But then later, you've got the reveal that of why he signed up. And so what were your kind of thoughts going into creating that character?
Yes, it was quite. And the backstory sort of emerges, doesn't it, as the story unfolds. And so I didn't do any more research than that, really, than just, I mean, it was quite, it must have been based on a true story, I think, because it's such an interesting progression that he had into getting this job as a wireless operator. But also the other thing about it was there were quite a few of these sort of shows set in the war at the time. And of course, there were people around who actually, the producer, he was a flying ace in the war. He was a DFC, so they really researched their stuff, and the stories, I'm sure, were historically accurate.
Yeah, absolutely. And they got people like they got advisors on who had actually been down and who went down the escape lines and things.
Yeah, the producer was he was an interesting man, Gerard Glaister, and he rose quite high in the BBC, I think, and certainly made, you know, well, hundreds of programmes. But they often had a wartime theme, because he'd been a pilot, and so there were several shows involving series involving aeroplanes, some of which I think he owned.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was one, I think it was called Buccaneer, that he produced. And he actually got hold of an old Britannia aeroplane, a cargo aeroplane, I think it was, and used that in the filming.
Yeah.
I don't know whether he sort of rented it out to the BBC, because it is quite a smart move, that if that really did.
It's a good side hustle.
And that's right. And then there was there was a follow up to Secret Army, wasn't there? I think it was called The Fourth Arm, was that it?
The follow-up to Secret Army would have been Kessler.
Oh, Kessler, that's right. Yeah,
but you're right in that The Fourth Arm was also, I think, another Jerry Glaister show. Yeah,
and he wasn't sort of physically imposing, but you knew he was an ex-RAF man.
Oh, really?
Wore a blazer, you know, and in what it was quite odd the way the sequence in which you made these programs in those days, and they all the BBC made all their shows like this, which was that you would get the job, and then they give you the script, and then you'd be given your filming dates. And now people probably find that the idea of there being pre-filming quite odd, because now it's, you know, it's just all done, nothing's done in a, very little is done in a studio now in the way that we did it.
It's all a rehearse record now.
That's just rehearse record. That's how you make sure. But what was odd about this was that you do quite a bit of the filming without any rehearsal at all, and then having finished the filming, you go into the rehearsal room and rehearse the show, which the remainder of which you would do in the studio at the end of a week.
Got you.
So if you had a lot, if you were in it a lot, then you'd sort of already done about nearly, well, maybe about sort of 25% of your, if not more, of your contribution before you started rehearsal. So
that's really interesting. Yeah. So you were then running around the mudflats of Norfolk and then rehearsing your scenes in a windmill with the other actors.
Yes, it wasn't Norfolk. It was.
Oh, was it not? Oh, sorry.
Was it Kent, or it was Rye and Winchelsea?
Oh, okay.
There's something, isn't there, that runs between Ryan Winchelsea, called the Royal Military Canal, I think. That's in Kent, I think, isn't it? It's just in Kent. So that was where all the sort of mud flap action happened. And the windmill was there. That's right, the windmill was there too. And so we were a few days, I don't know, it was that many days. I think it was, you know, 3 or 4 days there or something like that.
And what are your memories of filming on location?
Well, the mud, really. and one of the odd things about the character was he sort of escapes, doesn't he, at the end?
Yeah.
And then they capture him, and he's in this sort of mud bank trying to get to one side or the other. And I remember hanging onto a rope and trying to sort of pull myself out of the mud. And then the idea was that I would sort of collapse or fall unconscious. And I said to the director, am I actually dying here? because I think I'd been wounded as well or something. And he said, I don't know.
Right.
So I thought, well, I didn't, you know, I thought, well, he's the director.
Yeah, he can make a call on that.
I better be a bit careful what I say here, but I did ask him, did he know anybody who might know,
right,
the writer or producer or somebody, whether or not I was dead? And he said, I don't think it matters, really. So I thought, well, okay, if he's happy, then I suppose I am. So I don't actually know whether the character died or not.
That's really interesting, because I had never considered that. I just thought he was a bit tired and a bit injured, but, you know, they'd got him out and off camera he's going down the line eventually.
Yeah, but then one of the other characters, when the camera cuts away, it goes to one of the other characters, and they talk about my character in the past tense. So,
oh, okay.
You sort of think that's why I asked him whether I'd, and he obviously didn't know whether I was dead or not. So
I'll have to watch it again now and see it in that light.
But that's the impression you got. That I think that was probably what ended. Yeah.
Oh, really interesting. Yeah, that's funny that Victor's hadn't decided in that moment or didn't know.
No, he was quite. I was pretty young, and he, you know, he directed films and things, so he's quite established, and also a bit frightening. He was, well, is, I imagine, still is a bit frightening.
And in what way? Just his.
Well, just, I mean, he was just kind of steely eyed and upright sort of chap. You didn't want to mess with, really.
Got you.
And I was quite young and inexperienced, so I was a bit scared of him, I think. I mean, he's perfectly nice and easy to work with, but I was a bit intimidated, I think. But so we did the windmill and that, and that there's always this. When you look at, in fact, I made a programme about this TV show, about the period in BBC dramas where they did this sort of pre-filming, and then they would cut to the studio.
Mm.
And there were lots of examples of people leaping out of a window set to escape,
yeah,
and then landing in a completely different set of clothes to those that they jumped out in 2 months earlier on film. And so the wardrobe and continuity, you know, would all be carefully written down, or that was the hope. And of course it didn't really work out like that. And I remember doing the windmill thing, running out of the, I think I had to escape from the windmill and be shot at and fall over and tumble about and stuff. Anyway, I ran out, did my falling and whatever I was supposed to do. And after we'd finished, he said, right, that's okay, moving on. And I suddenly thought, is this right? Did I have the right clothes when I went into the windmill? And it turned out I didn't.
Oh, I didn't notice that either.
And then when it goes from the studio to the studio scene earlier, and then one set of clothes. And then I think there's a pre-filmed bit where I approach the windmill in another set of clothes, right, and emerge in a third set of clothes. I think that's right. But they may have cut around it, but that was what actually happened.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I didn't notice that either. So
he was sort of Victor's. I don't really think it was my fault, but Victor sort of gave the impression he did think it was my fault. I'm being quite upset about that.
It would be up to continuity and wardrobe, wouldn't they?
Well, I don't think they actually had a continuity person like they would on a movie. I think it was, you know, the first or second assistant, or, you know, would have to do that as well as his or her job.
Got you. Oh, that's interesting. Right, well, I'll have to get my freeze frame and compare your outfits.
Yeah.
In your episode, you also have some really nice two-hander scenes with Juliet Hammond. What was it like to do those scenes inside the windmill in the studio filming?
Yes, I didn't know her, but she's very easy to get on with and very welcoming, which was quite unusual, because those shows, they tended to have a bunch of regulars, and they'd been doing this show for quite a while. Certainly that was the case on the Anedian Line, which I was a regular in. And on the whole, the regulars didn't really talk that much. They were perfect to the visiting act. They were, you know, perfectly nice. There wasn't any hostility or anything like that. It's just, that was how it was. They just didn't really talk to the visitors. So I thought that would probably be the case on Secret Army. But in fact, Juliet was she was a regular and very welcoming. So, and she was, I think, quite a bit more experienced than me. So she was very kind in that respect. Yeah, it was fine. But I don't think I've ever met her since, whenever that was, 1977.
Yeah, I think she gave up acting in the late 80s. So there would have been less opportunities for you to bump into each other again or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was actually her first role, Secret Army. So yeah, that's really interesting that she had the air of experience. Yeah.
Really, I thought she was a few years older than me, but maybe she'd been to university and drama school or something. Yeah. I'd been acting quite a few years by the time I did that. So, you know, I was usually, although younger than a lot of the people I've worked with, I was quite experienced by that age.
So am I right in thinking you did some work as like stage managers in theatre and things like that, or ASM in theatre?
Yeah, I was a sort of stage carpenter, but when I was about 50, I left school when I was 15 and we just worked backstage. I just wanted to work in theatre. I didn't mind too much what I did. And then after I'd been doing that for a year or two, I got a job as an assistant stage manager at the Young Vic, which was then part of the National Theatre. It was the sort of the more alternative arm of the National Theatre on the other side of the road to the old Vic in the Cut in Waterloo. And they were short of actors for one production. So I got into acting through that. And once I'd done that, because it was such a smart theatre, the Young Vic at that time, it was like, I don't know, working at the Alameda or something now, it was pretty easy to get an agent. So I did. And then I just seemed to work all the time because there were so many parts and not enough young actors to play them.
I imagine as well, if you're kind of in your early 20s and can pass as a teenager, you probably
fit that
role of adult working hours, but looking younger as well.
That's right. So a lot of the time I had to be sort of, you know, bowling a hoop down the street or getting ridiculously excited about a game of catch or something. It felt really weird at the time, but that's just how it was.
But then I think in this episode of Secret Army, that's what really packs the emotional punch at the end, is you realise your character's just a teenager who's gotten caught up in really big events, and it's very moving.
Yeah. Jerry Glaister, I seem to remember him telling me a lot about what the life experience of this character would have been. I've forgotten everything he said, but I do remember finding that useful.
And can you remember any of the pointers he mentioned?
Well, it was actually, and there were other people in it. And I remember there was somebody who was meant to be a wireless operator or something, and he was quite stern with him because he had his headphones on and it, historically inaccurate way. But it was when as I said earlier, you do the filming and then you go into a rehearsal room and rehearse the rest of it before going into the studio. And this period when you went into the rehearsal room, that it was a big room, like, you know, sort of 40, 50 foot by 30 foot or something. And it was taped out. The set would be taped out on the floor of the rehearsal room. So in a show like that, you'd perhaps have 8 or 9 different scenes that would be shot in the scene settings that would be used in the studio. So they'd be taped out on the floor of the rehearsal room. And at the end of the rehearsal week, you had what was called the producer's run. So you ran through everything that you'd been rehearsing with the last few days in front of the producer. Producer would arrive, the tech people would arrive with their ground plans and would follow the action as it went, moved from one set to the other around the room. And it was sort of slightly, but, you know, it felt like more than a dress rehearsal. It felt, you know, that it was the first time important people were going to see this. So it was always a little bit nervous with producers around, but particularly with Jerry Glaister, because he had this kind of military bearing. And it was almost like an inspection of the state of your state of the hut, like a sort of officer coming round and inspecting the men, and you'd be sort of felt you needed to stand to attention almost while waiting for your scene. So it did add to the tension somewhat.
I can imagine that would really kind of add to the atmosphere of working on a wartime drama. How does it feel knowing that people are still revisiting Secret Army, or like myself, discovering it today?
It's interesting, isn't it, that so many of those shows of that time are now being rediscovered, and they were. I don't think anybody, the BBC now does have that very much in mind when it makes something, but I'm not sure it did then. I think that, you know, the main thing was to get it out and on the air, and there was this sort of huge demand for content, and BBC was, well, the commercial companies as well, but the BBC was very well resourced and able to do that. So there were, as I say, in this building, there were at any given time at least 24 shows being rehearsed in this building. And you'd see, you'd be in a lift with sort of Morecambe and Wise, and so it was all the BBC shows.
If I had a time machine, I would be paying the Acton Hilton a visit for sure.
Well, and the thing was that none of the press ever bothered to sort of doorstep the Acton Hilton. You think this was an obvious place for them to send staffers and just stand outside waiting for people to arrive, actors to arrive, perhaps in the morning with somebody they shouldn't have arrived with. You know? It was such an obvious thing to do, but they never did.
Yeah.
And so it was really a sort of actors' community. And since they stopped using it a few years ago, now they're celebrating it as this place where all these shows were made. And there are blocks of flats called, you know, the wardrobe store or makeup or something, you know, which nobody was interested in that time.
Yeah. Just a random question that's come to mind after your scenes in the mud flats. How does that work in terms of practicalities? Did they have like a hose on standby afterwards, or did you have to be muddied up until you could get back to a hotel, or how did it work practically?
Absolutely no recollection. I imagine, sometimes you would be left. you had to say, can you do something? I'm covered in mud.
Yeah.
I have no idea where my clothes are. You've taken them off in the wardrobe van. Please help me. I remember that. I remember I got when I was in the kneading line at the same time, and I was left up a mast.
Oh, really?
Went off to lunch, and I had to go up. And,
were you strapped in, and you just had to?
Yeah. Well, no, I was up the mast, and they fired the fire brigade were on the quayside firing the hose at me to simulate a storm. And then they obviously the expensive item was the fire brigade, so they wanted to make sure they didn't go over time. So they stood down the fire brigade and thought, well, that's it. We'll go off to lunch now. So
yeah,
I couldn't get down. Where my position in the crow's nest, wherever I was, so I had to wait to be rescued. The secret. There must have been some kind of wardrobe van or caravans nearby, I suppose.
Yeah, at least wipe yourself down. I love that about filming. I've seen a few episodes of The Aeneadine Line, and yeah, it often does look a bit like someone standing with a bucket of water, you know, simulating a wave going.
Yes, I mean, we did quite a lot of pre-filming on that because they had the use of these amazing ships, which just looked fantastic. They were the stars of the show, really. And I do remember once there was only the myth was that we all, when we filmed it in the studio, we all went,
we
were falling up, staggering about. And but I only remember once doing that with Peter Gilmore. And but you did have to stagger at the same time, otherwise, and in the same direction.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it just looked awful. So you had to remember your lines and the sort of moment of stagger. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Just to kind of bring things to a close, do you want to just mention the kind of things you're currently writing or working on at the moment? I imagine Ed Reardon might be on that list.
Yes. I've just written, and we've just recorded Series 15 of Ed Reardon's Week. Ed Reardon's Week is on Radio 4, and it's about a grumpy old writer who's had a terrible time. And I created it with my longtime writing partner, Andrew Nichols, who died last November. So we were about two episodes in, and we were on episode 3 when I just had to sort of take over and do it on my own, which was quite difficult at the time. This is obviously a very distressing time.
Because not only are you grieving the loss of someone really important in your life, you're then got a project as well that's open. Yeah. So
I managed to get, it took me a bit longer.
Yeah.
to finish the six scripts, but we did them, we just finished them. Yeah, the character survives.
And are you writing or adapting anything at the moment?
Well, I'm always sort of pitching adaptations, and I've got a few of those on the go at the moment. So the last few years, it's sort of, I've either been doing Ed Reardon or dramatizations or plays for Radio 4. The last one I did was The Odd Women by George Gissing. I did another of his novels, New Grub Street. And I also did an adaptation of Tristram Shandy in the last few years.
Yeah, there we go. We'll have to get listeners on the case to look out for all of those things. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
It's been fantastic to have you on the show.
Thank you.
AJ again here. I'd like to say another huge thank you to Chris for so generously giving up his time last summer to be a guest on the podcast, even though he was on holiday at the time. Chris's chosen cause is research into blood cancer, so if you've enjoyed this interview today, please do make a donation of any amount you wish. Blood Cancer UK is a charity dedicated to researching treatment and cures for leukemia, lymphoma, and all other types of blood cancer. The website is bloodcancer.org.uk and the donate button is in the top right-hand corner of the website. You can also donate by phone on 0808 169 5155. Thank you again so much for listening, and see you in 2 weeks' time.